You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row.
The Castle debates, set up and chaired by Pamela Castle, have been going for 8 years. The purpose of this annual event is to provide an objective and factual clarification of selected environmental issues. To this end, a panel of 3 or 4 experts addresses the applicable science, law, and policy. This year, we've recorded the session on the Environmental Principles and Governance Bill for LawPod UK. The panel discusses whether this draft bill is adequate to retain current environmental principles and enforcement mechanisms once we leave the EU. In this episode, you'll hear Environmental QC David Hart, followed by Peter Kellett, Director of Legal Services at the Environment Agency. Followers of the UK Human Rights blog will have seen David Hart's post setting out the main terms of the EU draft withdrawal agreement, which came out on the 14th of November. The deal, so far anyway, is that the UK should maintain EU levels of environmental protection in habitats, waste, water, and climate change for the while. The episode following this one will feature the rest of the speakers, and then you can hear the lively Q&A session in the final recording. The SoundCloud version of the full 2 hours with Pamela Castle chairing can be found on the Castle Debates website, castledebates.org.uk. So, let's go to David Hart, who explains how the draft bill came into being.
Chronology is quite important. The withdrawal bill was published in July 2017, at which point Michael Gove was only 1 month in office. He followed, how can I put it, some fairly undistinguished environment secretaries. But since he came in, there's been a bit of an oomph to do something about environmental matters and not just roll them over like everything else that is to happen in Brexit. And the clue is in the title, within the Environmental Principles and Governance Bill, because it seeks to address both. The original bill was completely silent as to that. But of course, the environment is not like great other chunks of EU law. Enforcement of environmental law has always been a struggle because you are not dealing, for instance, with competition where you've got somebody who's been shafted by somebody else, and the first person is quite liable to complain about that vociferously, particularly if they've got a lot of cash. So what matters and what has mattered in the environmental context is, of course, the European Commission as the enforcer. Enforcer against government. And ultimately, as you will all know, it can make government pay very, very large sums of money whilst government rate remains in default. So what the original bill did was just to say, well, we're rolling over all of the EU laws until we have some time and energy to amend them. And so all the black letter EU laws come into domestic law. But the original idea was that that did not contain any environmental principles, nor did it contain anything special about governance. So in May 2018, there was a consultation paper put out for the Governance and Principles Bill. That was whilst the Withdrawal Act was trundling through. One of the options in the consultation paper was, shall we embed these principles or shall we just have them as guidance? And the peers, whilst the withdrawal bill was trundling through, said, right, snap, we want those principles in law. And that is one of the origins of the part of the Withdrawal Act which deals with the environment. I can tell you about Section 61 because it's nice and simple. It says there shall be a governance bill, in effect, within 6 months of the passing of the withdrawal bill. So by Christmas this year, the government is mandated to publish a draft bill. What's to be in this bill? Again, mandatorily, as Section 16(1)(a) says, it must consist of a set of environmental principles. And it must also, this bill, must contain a duty on the Secretary of State to publish a statement of policy in relation to the application interpretation of those principles. So, principles and some policy in the bill. So if one just pauses and thinks about it, it's quite a weird animal, isn't it? This is an act saying there shall be a bill containing certain things. And it says the bill must consist of, however phrased. And then we have the precautionary principle, the principle of preventative action, the principle that environmental damage should as a priority be rectified at source, and the polluter principle. Now, just pausing there, those are all principles simply lifted from the relevant bit of the Treaty of the Functioning on the EU. They are set out pretty much verbatim. That's in Article 1912 of that treaty. And then we move to two further principles. The first is that, again, no surprises here, that there is a principle of sustainable development, whatever that means. And the second is that environmental protection requirements must be integrated into the definition and implementation of policies and activities. Now, both those provisions are taken from other measures within the treaties. So again, no surprises. What you're getting is direct, it would appear, direct rollover of these principles into domestic law. And the third batch of principles, which are not to be found in the treaty, can be described, broadly speaking, as Aarhus pillars, namely related to the Aarhus Convention. They are public access to environmental information, public participation in environmental decision-making, and access to justice in relation to environmental matters. Now, that's where the principles stop. So those are the mandatory ones that are to come out of this new bill. The European-minded will say, well, hang on, no, they all came from EU environmental law. They're simply lifted from that. Others will say, well, no, we've domesticated. We can do whatever we like with them. We can interpret them on the way we like. Now, that's what I was going to say on principles. What about the governance bit? And here we have, at D, a rather wordy thing. And I suppose the thing to pick up from this is all the provisos and hedges and that sort of thing. So we are to have a public authority with functions to taking, in circumstances provided for under the bill, proportionate enforcement action. Proportionate, one hopes, in the eye of the authority rather than the government who's being enforced against, including legal proceedings if necessary, where the authority considers that a minister of the Crown is not complying with environmental law as defined in the bill. So, circumstances, proportionality, and minister. Specificity of minister is, I suspect, something that will have occurred to all of you, not least because environmental law is, in fact, enforced or significantly affected by many bodies which are not a minister or which are not in law seen as a minister. Environment Agency, Natural England, Ofwat in terms of water pricing and water improvements, MMO in terms of the sea, local authority and the like. So the enforcement body set up is to address criticisms or orders or whatever to the minister. But what happens if the minister is not the person directly responsible for the default? Justification, which appears to be advanced in the consultation paper, is that if you made the minister answerable for all those bodies or similar bodies, it could, quote, undermine the rights and responsibilities of departmental ministers. Well, I suppose it could, but there are two ways of skinning this particular cat, aren't there? The first is to make the minister responsible for a list of material bodies, and the second is to make those bodies capable of being subject to an order under this provision. Understandably, those other bodies are not rushing to step up to the plate to say, well, actually, we would like to be here because we want to be involved in this. And so there seems to be a real difficulty, which we hope will be some constructive proposals for solving will be to be found in the bill. Just reflect on the just about current EU position. The EU, the Commission, can enforce against the UK no matter what bit of the UK state is responsible. And one can quickly come up with some examples which are quite important and which we need to think about projecting forward. The first is the UK has been in breach of the Urban Wastewater Treatment Directive in respect of sewage into the Thames and elsewhere for a while, hence the Tideway Tunnel, etc., etc. Who is arguably responsible for that? Is it DEFRA setting regulations? Is it Ofwat not funding the massive improvements that are now happening with the Thames Tideway Tunnel? Is it Thames Water, the entity that actually discharges the sewage into the Thames? Or is it, heaven forfend, the Environment Agency for setting discharge consents at a certain level? Well, arguably, they all have something to do with it. An order made by our new authority will only be able to focus on the minister. Two last reflections. In my humble view, there is actually something to be said for government for trying to get this one right and this one broad and inclusive, because there are advantages, as we've seen with the Commission proceedings, in there being a period of negotiation and to-ing and fro-ing between government on the one hand and the enforcing body on the other, in trying to sort stuff out before it gets to contested judicial review. Most European infringement proceedings settle way before it gets to the European Court. Doesn't seem to me as if anything is going to be settleable if you've only got the minister in circumstances where the reasons for a given infraction are multifactorial. The second thing which people have got to get right in this is the relationship between the set of enforcement proceedings and judicial review. Judicial review, as you know, has very strict time limits. The maximum is, in effect, 3 months, and in a planning case is 6 weeks. How on earth is one going to have a sensible way of engaging with the authority about a government decision which one is challenging within the sort of time period of 3 months, 6 weeks? It's simply not going to work. We're going to have to adjust one system one way or another in order to make sure that what this authority does and what the judicial review courts fit together sensibly for everybody's purposes. Those are my thoughts.
So now we've had a glimpse of what the bill is about, let's hear Peter Kellett's perspective from the Environment Agency. First of all, he considers the different constitutional arrangements envisaged by these proposals.
There needs to be a mechanism for informal, formal inquiry, a process in court that leads to a declaration. And I agree with David, it's a form of judicial review that's most likely to come out through this process. And at the European level, you know, it's really rare when you get to fines. Most things are sorted out informally, just about formally, and only a few get through the filtration and get to court. And what is proportionate enforcement action after all? Now, from my perspective, I think it's civil, it's not criminal. If we think about the mindset of enforcement, imagine, you know, ministers being interviewed under caution for not complying with environmental law. It's not that form of process. This is a form of civil process on the balance of probabilities. Environmental principles, which David touched upon, have underpinned successive environmental action plans and have delivered huge improvements over time. And the policy statement on principles will be important to scrutinise. You know, it could be weak, it could be powerful. We know roughly what, as a minimum, will be in it because of the Withdrawal Act. What we don't know is how much weight will be given to principles? How will they interact with each other? And in there is the fun in this, I think. I suppose the key question for me is actually what will the civil servant think when they get out of bed and go to their office about environmental principles as they start to try and solve an environmental problem in the future? Whether they work in an environment department or one that has an environmental impact. So that's the question, how much weight should they apply? Now, we've got this wonderful, overarching, ambitious 25-year plan for the environment, and it can and may deliver great outcomes over the period of its life. But who scrutinises it? And I think, again, that's one of those questions that this emerging bill will need to address. What's the scope of environmental law this scrutiny body will apply to? How will it scrutinise environmental law? Is it just retained European law? Because that's going to disappear over time as it gets replaced by domestic law after we exit. Or is it environmental law more broadly? I mean, clearly, if the scrutiny body has a purpose, it will be for environmental law more broadly, however we define that. And of course, you know, this debate about environmental law and how wide it is has gone on for decades. This is not a new question. Actually, the environment in planning, the environment in energy, the environment in transport, it has always been a question we have wrestled with. And I don't think there's anything new under the sun here. What is interesting, I suppose, is the public complaint role. And if you look at the Ombudsman currently, they scrutinise bodies like my body, the Environment Agency, and they take cases. And I think it would be a shame if there was a huge overlap between the scrutiny body operating as an ombudsman and the ombudsman, because I think therein lies confusion and waste. I think basically I'm just saying it's different and get used to it being different. The process for agreeing and developing legislation, I've had a huge pleasure over time to work on different pieces of the design of environmental law, its implementation, its compliance and enforcement. And you know, even before exit was on the horizon, it's immensely complicated as a process to turn bright ideas into law that applies on the ground. And right now, if you're a Secretary of State and you want to turn an idea into law, you have to go to a Cabinet Committee. It's called Parliamentary Business and Legislation Committee, and get permission, because there is limited time. And it decides on the bids that are successful. The bids that are successful depend on the political priorities of the government, which is exiting the European Union. And, remarkably, the Environment Department currently has the Environment Bill in gestation, the Agricultural Bill in Parliament, the Fisheries Bill in Parliament, and over 80 statutory instruments which are amending environmental law and making it work from day one. A huge exercise is going on to translate and convert law, and three bills running in parallel. You know, huge credit to my colleagues in the Government Legal Department who are simultaneously managing this so well, as they always do. So what happens in a department? Well, you create a bill team, and a bill team is full of people who know how to get this complicated process through. So you build policy, and policy turns into instructions to lawyers. And if it's primary legislation, you don't just need to persuade your departmental lawyers, you need to go along and persuade Parliamentary Council. Parliamentary Council have this reputation as being incredibly bright and incredibly challenging to persuade. So there is a long gestation and challenge process just with lawyers if you're a policy official. But also there's this consultation process. We've referred to the public consultation. There's a constant informal process of testing ideas. It's going on all the time with bill teams. And they say, will this work? How will this work? How would you advise us to approach this? And they reach out and do this constantly. And also, they have to work within their departments. And their departments have silos that will be working on other things that are equally important. And they have to persuade the people in their department that their proposals are aligned to what's happening in the department, and then on a bigger scale, what's happening across departments. So there's quite a complicated process. You need economists, impact assessments, you need to work out your questions and answers, manage your stakeholders and your political stakeholders. You know, it's a deft process that gets a bill through on time. You know, it's incredibly fun. If you're steering legislation through Parliament, you'll sit in the boxes, you're scratching notes, you're thinking about amendments, you're thinking about challenges, you think, well, will I accept this? Do I not accept this? It's a really interesting process, and it's a very exciting time to be A, an environmental lawyer, and be an environmental lawyer in the heart of government. So I think it is a really exciting time on the development of legislation. I'll move to the nature of independence, my third area. What would I look for in an independent scrutiny body? Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a completely independent scrutiny body because it's subject to the rule of law. It needs to act within its powers and fulfil its duties. It itself will be subject to judicial review, of course. You need checks and balances in any framework. And this body, you know, will be created by Parliament through statute. It needs to respect the separation of powers. You have Parliament, we have the government, and we have government, so we have the courts. And it feels slightly odd, I suppose, in that consultation, to have a parliamentary body that enforces against a government body. You can't do anything unless you can obtain information and then take action, some form of judicial review probably. And it needs the power to take the government, or government however defined, to court for non-compliance. Personally, having read the Clean Air judgments, courts have no problem with holding the government to account. So the courts are quite capable of fulfilling their role in this. What else affects independence? Who can direct the body? I mean, the ultimate power over an arm's length body is a direction power. You know, the absence or presence of a direction power is really important, because ultimately if a public body is acting in the direction the minister doesn't feel is appropriate, a direction can pull it back. Who appoints the executive on this body? Interesting question. We do appointments quite well in the UK, I think. So we do need to trust and think quite carefully. I mean, even the European Commission has European commissioners who are political appointees, but we don't have politicisation of the tiers down, which I think is the right form of model, whatever comes out. So lastly, I'll just touch on practicalities. The last time I can remember a big environmental public body being set up was Natural Resources Wales, which was a carve out of us and the combination with Forestry and Countryside Commission for Wales. And even when there was political clarity, it took 18 months and there was no problem or debate in Parliament. It was, there will be a body. It took 18 months to set it up. And we were working really fast to get it going. If you create a new public body, you need a transition period. You need a budget. You need leadership, procurement, IT, processes. You need to build a body before it takes powers, and then it can operate. What else would I say? Well, what's my failure then success? I think it would be tragic if the new body leads to fewer people on the ground enforcing and complying and forcing compliance with environmental law. You know, at this point in time, I've got 250 cases in court or going to court about compliance with environmental law. And if it detracts from that role of getting compliance with environmental law, it would be a mistake. But at the systemic level, the scrutiny body is about systemic non-compliance with environmental law. And if that is its role, I really wish it well. Thank you.
So much for the multifold difficulties of enforcing environmental standards. In the episode to follow, we'll hear some of the responses from an environmental consultant and campaigner. Should this country set itself as an example to the world? Will withdrawal from the EU mean a race to the bottom or to the top in terms of environmental stewardship?
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.